Hey y'all. How's things? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm live in New Hampshire at the New Hampshire Liberty Forum. Got Ian Freeman here giving me the thumbs up on the technologicals. So hopefully that means everybody can hear me okay. Appreciate y'all tuning into the show. I might be going over my speech with you a little bit because I get nervous as hell before I give a speech. And I'm giving a speech right after the show today. I'm going on in the other room to oppose the terror war. And, I don't know. I guess my speech is pretty much ready, but I get kind of nervous when I do these things. So I might go over it some with you here. But I got plenty of news to cover. I got Jeff Tucker coming up. He's here live, so we'll give you a little bit of that Eye on the Empire radio version here on the show. Should be all right. But before we go too much further into the subject matter, let me thank you, everyone, for chipping in on the Kickstarter. I've been trying so hard to get this thing going for so long, and it kept getting put off, but my friend Matt Perry has got this thing together, this Kickstarter together. We're asking for $675 so that we can hire this guy Carlos, who's one of these level 20 computer geniuses, who's going to put all 3,600 plus interviews on YouTube for me. Well, I raised more than the 675 within like 15 hours, 16 hours, something like that. And right now we're more than double the amount of money we were trying to raise. And so, you know, first of all, thank you. Jesus, you guys are generous and I can't believe it. I really do appreciate it. And then secondly, when I get back to Austin, I guess on Monday, then I'm going to get to work on putting out a survey, whatever, to try to see how you guys feel about it. I mean, there's no deception. It says right there on the page that we're already above our limit, so I don't think anybody is donating under the mistaken impression that we're still under our goal. But then again, on the other hand, I think many of you guys probably heard me saying that I got another Kickstarter lined up to come next, which would be to buy a new server, because I got my own server that's run by volunteers, but the thing's janky, 10 years old. We need a new one. And Sneaker says we need, I think, $1,000, $1,500, $2,000, something like that, to get all the new servers up and going. So on Monday, I think what I'm going to do, there's like a survey that you can do at Kickstarter. So I'm going to ask everybody, if you approve, if that's cool with you guys, we're just going to extend, I don't think you can extend the time limit, but we're going to extend the purpose of the Kickstarter to try to include those new servers as well and see if we can get all of that wrapped up within the first couple of weeks here and be done, so I don't have to keep begging you guys for money all the time. But mostly I just want to say thank you. It's incredible to me how generous you guys are, and I'll take it to mean that you value the show. So thank you. That's great of you. If anybody else wants to chip in, just go to scotthorton.org. It's all right there in the right-hand margin. You can find the link to it, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, it's just scotthorton.org/kickstart if you want to go and check it out. But I'm really excited because I think, cross fingers, once we get the 3,600 interviews up there on YouTube, I'm really hoping that'll lead to a whole new audience of people who will be able to find the archives and get interested and maybe go back and listen to some of the old ones and all that kind of thing. So I'm really excited about it, and I really appreciate it. Okay. All right, let me check my time here. Oh, good. I still got plenty of time to talk. First of all, it looks like Wes Kremer has won Skater of the Year. Oh, that's the wrong magazine. Sorry. I don't even know who Wes Kremer is, but I did see some pictures in here, and he's got it together. There ain't no lie there. Boy, do I feel old reading Thrasher. All right. I got a live studio audience. I don't know. All right. Can you hear Ian Freeman mocking me and laughing in the background? Very good to have him here, and the rest of y'all, thank you for showing. Nice to have a live studio audience. I want to mostly do Terror War stuff because I want to try to refresh my brain for the speech I got to give here in a few minutes. But let me talk, first of all, here real quick, before we go to this first break, about Gareth Porter's new piece at Middle East Eye. And I still can't get my head around the fact that he has left Interpress Service, although I guess that was going to happen eventually. But he's got this great one at Middle East Eye, and we're rerunning it at antiwar.com. Just go antiwar.com/Porter. And it's called The Long History of Israel Gaming the, quote, Iranian Threat. And this is material from his book, A Manufactured Crisis, more or less. It's the story you might remember from my interviews with Gareth a year ago when the book came out about this, about how Yitzhak Rabin, actually the prime minister who was assassinated by a right-wing Zionist lunatic back in 95, 96, he actually was the first Israeli prime minister to decide, let's make a fake crisis out of Iran. You know, the Israelis helped Ronald Reagan sell weapons to the Iranians long after the revolution, all the way through the 80s. They maintained their relationship with the Iranian intelligence services, etc. All this is in Trita Parsi's book, Treacherous Alliance. It wasn't until the mid-90s that the Israelis decided that they would make Iran a big fake threat. And then the irony of irony, the reason why, was because Yitzhak Rabin was trying to make peace with the Palestinians. He was trying to give up the West Bank and the Gaza Strip to be a second Palestinian state. And this is the same reason that he got shot to death. But what he was trying to do was say, hey, look, everybody, Iran is a terrible threat. Pay attention to that while I make peace with the Palestinians. Well, irony of irony, of course, that this has been ever since Rabin got shot and Netanyahu came into power in 1996. And then from Netanyahu, it was Sharon and then Olmert and now Netanyahu again. Stop me if I miss somebody in there. And they have all made Iran the pretend threat in order to distract from the fact that they refuse to make peace with the Palestinians. They refuse to follow Yitzhak Rabin's lead. They refuse to follow the Oslo Accords and give up the occupation and control of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem to the Palestinians. And so, just like Netanyahu's speech in front of the Congress last week, you don't even hear reference to the Palestinians whatsoever. No one's ever even heard of the Palestinians. What the hell is a Palestinian? Jerusalem belongs to the Israelis, the entire city undivided forever and ever, eternally, and blah, blah, blah. That was the only reference to Palestinians at all, and they were unpeople in the reference. And why? Because, look, everyone, Iran, 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 they're trying to kill us. They're going to kill us. It's just like that time that Hitler and the Nazis tried to kill all the Jews, says Benjamin Netanyahu. And it's just purely a lie. And it seems to me like people would actually start to resent the lie when they hear the exact same lie over and over again for years at a time. Benjamin Netanyahu himself has been calling out the Iranian so-called nuclear weapons threat for now 20 years. Since the mid-1990s, he's been saying they're a couple of years away. They're a couple of years away from a nuclear bomb. And I'll talk more about the talks and Iran's actual nuclear program here in a minute. But don't you think that if the Iranians were making nuclear weapons for the last 20 years that they'd have at least one by now? Does anybody ever wonder about that? Or, I don't know, maybe the Israeli prime ministers lie all the time. One of the headlines, which I did not see at antiwar.com this morning, but was on my Twitter, on my phone, was the former head of Mossad, Meir Dagan, actually used the word, not the initials, BS. He said Netanyahu's speech before the Congress was just nonsense, to be polite. That's Meir Dagan, the guy who takes credit, probably dishonestly, for stopping Netanyahu from launching the war back in 2012. I don't think Netanyahu ever really had the courage to launch a war without an agreement with Barack Obama to back him up beforehand. But Meir Dagan, the former head of Mossad, has been calling out Benjamin Netanyahu over and over and over again on his reckless Iran policy and on his lies about what Mossad's actual estimate is of Iran's nuclear technology. Mossad has been telling the truth, just like the CIA since at least 2007, that there is no nuclear weapons program in Iran. There never was. And certainly any research into nuclear weapons was completely called off back in 2003, and they haven't made a political decision to change that whatsoever, which of course puts the lie to every word out of the prime minister's mouth. All right, anyway, more like this. On the other side of this break, it's the Scott Horton Show on Liberty Radio Network, live from the Liberty Forum in New Hampshire.
the whole time.
Look, man. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, live at the Radisson in Manchester, New Hampshire, for the New Hampshire Liberty Forum. I saw Jeff Tucker at breakfast this morning. He's going to be joining us after a little while, do a little bit of Eye on the Empire. He's got a studio audience of a relatively small size, but I'll take it. Hey, guys, thank you for hanging out. Gordon Prather is an entirely different individual. Look at Gareth Porter's article today at antiwar.com about the Israelis very cynically pretending that the Iranians are some kind of threat to the Israeli state to distract from, in the case of Rabin, peace with the Palestinians. In the case of Netanyahu, never peace with the Palestinians. But regardless, to keep people's mind off the Palestinians, which... kind of makes me feel like a tool, because instead of talking about the Palestinians now, I'm going to keep on with the distraction of the ridiculous nuclear program and the fake controversy here. The deal about Iran's nuclear program is that it's a matter of pride. It's a symbol of Iranian independence from the American Empire. And there is no way, there is absolutely zero chance ever, without a full-scale American regime change, that the Iranians are going to give up their nuclear program. The good news is they're not making nuclear weapons, and they never were. Now, it's true, I guess, if I got to try to concede something to the war party here, it's that the Iranians' conception, their government's conception of a nuclear deterrent is kind of a half-assed nuclear deterrent. They don't need nuclear bombs. What they need is a nuclear capability, a threshold capability. Now, if you listen to Netanyahu, what he's saying is, yeah, because they're going to break out and try to make a nuclear bomb and then kill all Israelis in a minute as soon as they can. The truth is that they have about a half a nuclear deterrent already. And if you hear even the warmongers talk about it, they talk about, well, you know, if we did bomb them, we could even really harm their, you know, especially if America did it, not Israel. We could really, you know, cause a lot of chaos to their nuclear program. On the other hand, they turn right around and start making nuclear weapons at that point. You can't destroy the knowledge or the mastery of the fuel cycle. They've already mastered it. So the threat is not that they're going to make nuclear weapons and then use them in a first strike on Israel or some ridiculous thing like that. The threat is that they can maintain their independence from America and our empire by maintaining the nuclear deterrent. Now, the controversy right now is that for whatever reason, I don't claim to really understand completely, maybe just domestic politics, Obama has decided to accept this fact. Iran, we can't do a regime change there. It's about three times the size of Iraq, four times the population of Iraq, and it's not flat desert. It's all mountains. Okay, so we're talking about the entire American military invading Iran for years to try to conquer that country. It's just absolutely impossible, and no one is floating that. No one thinks that that's a possibility. And so basically Obama's decided, apparently, to go ahead and respect the fact that the Iranians have achieved enough of a deterrent to maintain independence from the United States, which means that more or less his conception of our future relationship with Iran going forward would be to treat them like we treat China and like we treat Russia, who are, as far as I can think of, North Korea, I guess, but that's kind of different. With Russia and China, these are countries who they have their independence from us, and there ain't a damn thing that the Americans can do about it, and they know it, because Russia and China have the H-bomb. And so instead, we have this relationship that Nixon and Kissinger created with China, and that H.W. Bush and Clinton, the Russia relationship is sort of a different story. But the point is, we more or less respect their independence because we know that we can't do anything about it. And I think Obama has decided, if only because he needs some kind of win, he needs to go down in history as a president who achieved something before he's kicked out of here. And so he's decided that he wants to have a de facto peace with Iran. Now, a nuclear deal with Iran is not a peace treaty. It's not a real end of the Cold War, and I think the Cold War against Iran probably will remain through the rest of Obama's presidency. But there's no way to understate the importance of the nuclear issue in terms of obstructing any kind of further rapprochement. We've got to get this out of the way. And I'm the first to tell you, and I told you all along, it's a fake issue. It's not a crisis. It's, well, as Gareth Porter puts it in his book, it's a manufactured crisis. They never were making nukes, and they never were threatening us with them. However, if Obama can make this nuclear deal, then that is a huge first step toward making peace with Iran, right? That is a de facto peace treaty with Iran, because you can cry and complain about Iran backing Hezbollah or whatever you want into the future. But if with the nuclear threat, supposed nuclear threat, off the table, then that really makes it that much easier for, you know, future cooling off, and it makes it that much more difficult for Benjamin Netanyahu and the war party here in the United States to pretend that Iran is such a unique evil in the world that we just can't talk with them. And so if you have a problem with that, blame Benjamin Netanyahu and George W. Bush. Blame Ariel Sharon and Ehud Olmert as well. George W. Bush could have had a deal with Iran in 2003 that would have included almost certainly all but the complete abandonment of Iran's nuclear program. It was called the Golden Offer. And in fact, Hillary Mann Leverett and Flint Leverett have told that story on this show before. The Iranians had the Swiss ambassador bring them a peace deal that said, we are willing to negotiate everything. We will negotiate support for Hamas and Hezbollah. We will negotiate our nuclear program. We will negotiate working with you guys in your war in Iraq, which America fought on behalf of Iran the whole time, even though they pretended they weren't. We'll work with you on anything, they said. And the Americans reacted to this so badly, they actually dressed down the Swiss ambassador for having the temerity to even bring the peace offer. And by the way, you can find the PDF of the Golden Iranian Peace Offer online. The document is right there on the internet. You can find it if you Google around a little bit. Include PDF in your search terms, and it'll come up. And at that point, in 2003, America could have negotiated a deal with Iran that would have guaranteed that, well, it's at least very likely that they could have gotten the Iranians to agree to import all their nuclear fuel rather than have a domestic enrichment program whatsoever. And then from 2003 through 2005, America had a pseudo negotiation process going on by way of the E3, which is Britain, France, and Germany. And they were negotiating on America's behalf because the George Bush policy was, we are angels and the Iranians are devils, and so therefore we refuse to grace them with our presence, to even speak with them, to negotiate with them about anything. And so at that point, in 2003 through 5, they had no centrifuges spinning in Iran anywhere. And that deal fell apart because the E3 was not negotiating in good faith because the Americans weren't on board. And so now it is the case, 10 years later, that the Iranians have 10,000 centrifuges that need to be negotiated. Music plan, gotta go. Right back, live from the New Hampshire Liberty Forum, right after this. All right, y'all, welcome back. Let's talk about how George W. Bush is the tiny little servant of the Ayatollah Khomeini. Now, everything George Bush ever did was because the Ayatollah Khomeini tricked him into it. You see, Ahmed Chalabi, who furnished all of the defectors, who came up with all the lies about the weapons of mass destruction in 2002 and 2003, he was an Iranian spy. And number one clue would be his headquarters was in Tehran, huh? You'd think that CIA might have caught on to that. But anyway, that's where they got the lies about the warehouses full of Sarin and VX and Anthrax. That's where they got the lies about the mobile biological weapons labs. That's where they got the lies about nuclear centrifuges all throughout the country. That's where they got the WMD lies to lie the people into war, was the Iranians sent their spy Ahmed Chalabi to fool George Bush and his Israel firster neoconservative friends into getting rid of Saddam Hussein for them. George Bush said that Saddam and the Ayatollah were in an axis together. But any of us who can remember the 80s remember that Ronald Reagan and George Bush's father paid Saddam Hussein to contain the Iranian Revolution by invading Iran and killing 500,000 Iranians for over the course of 8 years. So no, they were not in an axis together. They were avowed enemies. And what George Bush did in invading Iraq in 2003 was he wasted 5,000 American soldiers' lives and 1 million Iraqi lives in order to give Baghdad to Tehran, in order that Tehran's sock puppets, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and the Dawa Party and their United Iraqi Alliance would take over Baghdad and, again, kill almost 1 million people in a civil war to force all the Sunnis out. So you might notice that whenever you hear the war party going on and on and on about Iran, they're the very same ones who said that we ought to invade Iraq back in 2003. The very same ones who did the very nicest thing for the Ayatollah that anyone could have ever done in his entire lifetime, which was reverse the policy of Reagan Bush and deliberately import the Iranian Shiite revolution into Iraq. And that's why we have the Islamic State in Iraq right now, is because they are the group of the meanest of the Sunni fighters who grew up to protect the Sunnis from the Shia that George Bush was fighting for in that 8-year civil war. And so that's where Al-Qaeda in Iraq comes from. Why would any of the Sunni Iraqis ever let a bunch of berserker, beheader, crucifier, suicide bomber, lunatics take root in their society? War is the health of the state. War is the health of the Islamic State. And from the point of view of the terrorists, the Sunni terrorists, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, now called the Islamic State, they have basically one piece of propaganda, which is, who's going to protect you from the Shiites? Who's going to protect you from George Bush's reversal of Ronald Reagan's policy and the deliberate importation of the Shia their takeover of Baghdad? And so that's a big part of the speech today. I'm going to try to be brief about the Shia part of it, because I really want to cover the Islamic State more. But people ought to understand that when the Sunni Iraqis talk about the Shia Iraqis, they call them Iranians, even though they're actually Arabs and they're 60% of the population of Iraq. The Sunnis call them the Safavids, which is a reference to the ancient Persian Empire that came and dominated Iraq 1,000 years ago, or whatever it was. And just as the Shia of Iraq call the Sunnis all Al-Qaeda, even though, of course, that's hardly true at all. This is the damage done from the American war there. And in fact, I'm glad that member of the studio audience kind of got me going on Iran there for a minute, because it reminded me that I want to Google up, and hopefully, I don't know what they're like for visual aids here, but my speech is coming up here in just a little while, and I want to have a map of what's called now called the Shiite Crescent that I can show people. People really like maps for when you're talking about what's going on somewhere. And here's a good map of the Shiite Crescent. It was coined the Shiite Crescent by the King of Jordan, America's loyal sock puppet, the King of Jordan, right back after the invasion of Iraq. He said, now look, now the Shia control Baghdad too. They control Tehran, Baghdad, Damascus, and southern Lebanon, where Hezbollah lives. And so, let's see, this is not the picture I want to use, because I want to be able to show people that the entire effect of the second Iraq war, which was really 2.5 if you count Bill Clinton's genocide throughout the 1990s, but what George W. Bush accomplished in Iraq War II was he moved the line of the Shia just a little bit on the map. 1 million people killed just to get the Sunnis kicked out of Baghdad, to give the capital city to the Shia. and guaranteeing 1,000 years of strife to come, because it took the American Army and Marine Corps to give Baghdad to the Shia. So it's going to take a force that powerful to take it back from them. But believe me, from now on, it is absolutely going to remain intolerable by the Sunni leaders in the region that the Shiites control in Arab capital cities, the first time they have since Cairo in the year 1100 and something. And so in doing that, he basically just set up chains of dominoes that are just going to fall back and forth, you know, throughout the decades, for the rest of the century probably, the strife created by accomplishing that. And then, you know, a big part of the speech, too, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to, you know, really gel it all together in a way like I want to, but, you know, a big part of this, a big part of the Islamophobia in America and all the narrative portraying Islam as the root of America's terrorist problem is really just a bunch of Israeli lies. What they're trying to do is get you to confuse the Caliph Ibrahim of the Islamic State and the Ayatollah Khamenei, his avowed enemy. And what Netanyahu says outright is, there's no difference. Islamic State, Islamic Republic. Get it? Islamic. Right? Even though these guys are absolutely at odds with each other. And it is, you know, right now the newly empowered Iranian Empire, empowered by America, versus the Islamic State. But the Islamic State, even though they've thrown off their loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of al-Qaeda, they still claim Osama bin Laden. And they are still loyal, you know, the al-Nusra Front in Syria, for example, they are still loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri himself. But the Islamic State still claims that they're bin Ladenites, that this is the fulfillment of what bin Laden wanted with the creation of this caliphate. So in the minds of the American people, hey, you know, maybe we don't like it when the Iranians chant death to America all the time or whatever, but they didn't knock our towers down. The last time the Iranians killed Americans was in 1983 in Beirut. The Americans were in Beirut, and it, in fact, it wasn't even Hezbollah that did it. It was the Amal militia that did it at the time, but it was tied to Iran. But that was in 1983, and that was when, and Ronald Reagan decided that rather than double down, he would do the right thing and get the hell out. What was I thinking putting the Marines in Beirut in the first place? That was stupid, so he withdrew them, and Ron Paul at the time praised him for finally doing the right thing. In getting them out of there. But it wasn't the Iranians who knocked our towers down. It was al-Qaeda who killed 3,000 Americans. It's Ayman al-Zawahiri who's the butcher of New York. And the ISIS fighters, in the minds of the American people, if anyone is our enemy over there, it's them. It's not the Iranians who aren't making nukes, who are not backing al-Qaeda, who are the enemies of al-Qaeda. So to the American people, I don't get it, Netanyahu, why you're always talking about Iran and Hezbollah and Syria all along when the enemies, the bin Ladenites, they're the ones who are the bad guys if you ask the American people. And so what Netanyahu does is he says, radical Islam, radical Islam, radical Islam. And then he has, I can't remember the guy's name. But there's a great couple of studies by the Center for American Progress. I know, that's the Democrats. That's not even the liberals. That's the Democrats, okay? They're pure evil. But they've done great studies, two of them, a few years apart, called Fear, Inc., about the Islamophobia industry. And it's a very, very small, very, very tight-knit group of people at the top who are deliberately spreading this propaganda, trying to get the American people to conflate all of Israel's enemies together. And that's what's behind them trying, you know, always emphasizing radical Islam and completely ignoring the fact that in the Middle East right now is a massive sectarian civil war where all these guys are opposed to each other, not united against us. Back in a sec. Okay, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Worden. This is my show, Scott Worden Show. Radio Network. Weekday is noon to 2 Eastern. I'm actually in the Eastern time zone right now. I'm live at the Liberty Forum in New Hampshire. I guess it's the New Hampshire Liberty Forum at the Radisson Hotel here in Manchester. Hey, if you're within earshot, come on out. I'm going on in about an hour and 15 minutes. I'm giving a talk here against the terror war. Right now I got a little bit of a live studio audience. Hey guys, appreciate y'all hanging out here and making me feel very self-conscious about the radio show I'm doing. I found it. I couldn't remember the guy's name. I can't remember how much of this conversation was on the air or off the air. I don't know anymore. Now I'm trying to think of it. Maybe I was wrong that he was a rabbi, but the guy's name is David Yerushalmi. You see why I can't memorize it? It's because I can't pronounce it right. David Yerushalmi, Yerushalmi. He is the guy who, with Frank Gaffney, is helping to bankroll and organize and lead this entire Islamophobia movement across America. And, you know, this is kind of part of my talk, too, is how, you know, the conservatives, they already have their answer. We're good. And the people who are against us, well, they believe in Islam. And Islam makes them hate things that are good and want to kill things that are good. Hence, we're on the defensive against this evil Islamic empire that is trying to convert all our kids and cut all our heads off and all this kind of crap. The Democrats' answer to that is, no, they just need a LBJ Great Society jobs program over there in Sunni Stan, and that'll make them abandon ISIS. They just need some good jobs. Well, the thing of it is this. There are more than a billion Muslims in the world, right? Which means that if you take the highest estimate of ISIS plus Al-Qaeda, you've got 100,000 men, you've got 0.01% of Muslims on earth who are involved in these movements. So the rest of them, I guess, are just faking it and don't really believe in their religion? Or they do, but it's not their religion that mandates this kind of policy. And then you take the poverty issue. Well, I don't know, a good billion of the 7 billion humans on this planet go hungry daily. A billion of them. So again, take the highest estimates you can get of ISIS plus Al-Qaeda. Still 100,000 people or less on this planet. 0.01% of them. So you could correlate poverty and you could correlate Islam to America's terrorist enemies, and yet we seem to be lacking causation here. These answers are not quite good enough. And that's because the real answer is that George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton got us into this mess by mass murdering hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people all through the 1990s. And then when the revenge came in the form of the September 11th attack, the policy became, hey, let's pretend today's the first day in the world, and that rather than a reaction against anything we've been doing, that this is the leading edge in a fight that's been started against us, and now we have to go and defend ourselves. Now, show me the Democrat who's going to admit that this is because of Bill Clinton. In fact, I interviewed the young lady from the Center for American Progress who wrote this report, Fear 2.0, and we talked about how the Republicans and the Israelis are such liars trying to make this about Islam. How dare they? And then I said, yeah, but the Democrats suck too. They want to say we need a jobs program and that's the solution to this because they're too afraid to just say that it's because of Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton occupied the Arabian Desert for 8 years straight. He bombed Iraq on average every other day. That's not a lie. He bombed Iraq on average every other day for 8 years straight, enforcing a United Nations blockade that makes the embargo on Cuba look like nothing. Cuba could still trade with everybody but us. The blockade on Iraq was an entire United Nations Security Council mandate on every nation on this planet. They starved, they murdered 1 million Iraqis with that blockade in the 1990s. Now show me the think tanker at the Center for American Progress who's going to admit that when their entire goal in life is to get Hillary Clinton elected next. When, hey, wasn't it her husband who's the number one cause of the September 11th attack other than the 19 hijackers and their four or five bosses? Wasn't it Bill Clinton who was the most responsible? And so because of partisanship, we have Ron Paul is not even in office anymore, was the only person who's actually willing to tell the truth about this. His son, of course, says, no, the problem is radical Islam, because that's what Israel wants me to say. The problem is radical Islam. The problem is you're discriminating a bit too much when you try to tell the difference between the Iranians and the Saudis and the and the Iraqis and the whoever. The problem is Islam, because it's the simple answer. And now, of course, if you're Jewish or Christian and somebody tells you this and you don't know the history, I guess it sounds plausible. I mean, I have to admit that the visuals of the September 11th attacks are basically perfect for lies. You can see with your own eyes, here the planes come out of the clear blue sky. There's no better metaphor for like just being completely lost, completely caught out in the middle of nothing. What happened here? How could this have happened? As the visuals themselves bring massive question marks with them. It's not a self-explanatory thing unless you already know the history. And so when George Bush said they hate us because we're free, you had 99% of the American people were willing to accept that because they didn't know a better answer. And, you know, this is in fact why they call it blowback. Blowback doesn't just mean consequences from things you did. Blowback means consequences of covert action, consequences of policies that were carried out in secret. And then when the consequences come due, they're very apparent to everyone. But then that leaves the people puzzled, and in fact it leaves the people basically helpless before their politicians, who would take the opportunity to fill their head with lies. And so, you know, I met an auto mechanic, was working on my truck, who talked about how, oh yeah, you know, all this and all this and all this, it's all just a bunch of lies, and they want to keep us at war all the time, and it's all just a bunch of lies, it all is. But the Iranians, boy, they hate us. They just hate us. Oh, they hate us so much. They hate us. They hate us. They hate us. They burn our flag. They stomp on our flag. They call us the great Satan. Oh, they hate us. They hate us. They hate us. And he's known this nonstop since 1979. Those Iranians, boy, they just hate us. He never asked in his whole life why, right? It must just be because we're from North America. And boy, those Iranians hate North Americans. But of course, the real answer is because they lived under an American-backed fascist sock puppet dictatorship for 26 years, a dictatorship that murdered them, that tortured and killed them. And there's hardly a person in Iran, at least back at that time, who didn't have someone who was their close friend or family who was tortured, beaten, abused, mistreated by the government of the Shah Reza Pahlavi. That's why they hate us. They didn't wake up hating us. They don't hate us because, as he put it, they just hate us. They hate us as a consequence of covert action, of secret foreign policies. Now, in fact, the American people could have known, should have known, that America backed the Iranian government. But they really don't understand that America's an empire. They really don't understand that if it was not for the United States, the Shah would not have been the dictator of Iran. If not for the United States, Mubarak would not have been the dictator of Egypt. They don't understand that. And so, you know, people are only kind of willing, I guess, to go back so far in their own history and their own understanding. And like, yeah, you know, Al-Qaeda, that's all revenge for what Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton did. But man, those Iranians, they just hate us. And these, you know, the American people, mostly, even libertarians. You know, I did Ernie's show yesterday, and Ernie explained to me, I interview you once every few months because I don't pay any attention to this stuff whatsoever. And you're doing my work for me, so thanks for filling me in. Most libertarians aren't interested in this stuff either. Most Americans just aren't interested in foreign policy. But that means that we leave ourselves open to being lied to and manipulated. And, you know, it's really a sad deal, especially when such a major part of it is this Islamophobia. This, you know, I don't know how bad it was during the Red Scare or you know, what have you. But it is just, you know, the war party in America appealing to the very lowest kind of thinking and emotions on the part of the American people. You know, how can I make you hate and fear your neighbor, right? Not even some foreign country I want you to cheer while we bomb it. I want you to hate and fear your neighbor because that'll make it easier for me to get you to cheer when we bomb the next country we bomb too. And it's just absolutely disgusting. And particularly since it has no basis in reality whatsoever, when there are 3 to 5 million American Muslims, all of whom go to work, take care of their kids, and don't hurt anyone all day long in this country. That's the reality.
All right, guys, welcome back. It's the Scott Horton Show here on Liberty Radio Network. Got a little bit of a live studio audience here at the Radisson in Manchester, New Hampshire, where I'm at the Liberty Forum. Thank you, everybody, for having me here. The organizers, the sponsors, the attendees, for making it a thing. I appreciate it. I'm giving a speech here in about 50 minutes against the terror war, kind of going over some of the themes in it with you guys here, and then possibly, I haven't seen him in a little while, but I'm hoping Jeff Tucker's going to drop by, and we'll talk a little bit about the Eye on the Empire live here in studio. I got to talk to him for a minute earlier. There's a lot going on here, though, so I'm not sure if he's going to make it or not. Anyway, I completely X'd out the part about the Iranian Revolution. I completely X'd out the part about the Iran-Iraq War and the first Gulf War. And my speech is still way too long. I have no idea how I'm going to get through this thing. I always way overdo it. So I guess as I go through here, I'm just going to fail. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do, guys. I'm gonna skip ahead to the libertarian part at the end. I got a whole libertarian part at the end for you. My big speech against the terror war coming on here in just a little while. Well, so here's a part that I haven't really gone over very much toward the end of the speech. It's something maybe I'll kind of go over with you guys here a little bit. Might help me out. And that would be about the rise of the Islamic State and what to do about it. I mean, the truth is the Islamic State is the boogeyman they pretended that Saddam Hussein was. Saddam Hussein was America's loyal sock puppet, really. Was no harm, no threat. To anyone other than Iraqis. The Islamic State, they're basically a bunch of Khmer Rouge lunatics. If you go on the Life Leak, you can sit there and just watch video after video of them executing unarmed prisoners. There's footage of, I don't know, like a basketball court, almost sized parking lot, just full of Shia captives. And the ISIS guys are just machine gunning them all to death. There's footage of them bragging and boasting of throwing homosexuals off the top of tall buildings as their punishment. Oh, yeah, that's right there in the Quran. I'm so sure. And they're freaking devils, man. The Caliph Ibrahim and his core leadership, they're horrible bastards. And that's part of why not to fight them. That's part of why we don't need to fight them, is because they are making sure to make more and more enemies for themselves all day, every day. That's all they can do. They can't help but do it. And if you look at a map, and this, I really am going to have to get my maps together here for my visual aid for the thing. I would really like to show people a map of Iraq. And I don't know how well everybody can picture Iraq in your head, but if you can and you picture all the land to the west of Baghdad and up to the north as well, that's basically Sunnistan. That's the new Islamic State part of Iraq anyway. And it's eastern Syria as well. But if you picture the map and just go around, start at 12 o'clock and go around clockwise. In the north, you have the Turks, who apparently don't really hate the Islamic State, but they certainly have the power to keep them out. And they have been, Mitchell Prothero said, they really have been clamping down on the black market oil smuggling, which is a big part of their revenue. And unlike in usual black markets, of course, oil is traded on an open market. The only reason it's being traded on the black market here is because it's who's doing the selling. And so they're having to sell what oil they can sell at a major discount over the already low price. So instead of like, you know, drugs where it's artificially high price because it's contraband, it's an artificially low price here. So there's the Turks in the north. And then let's just go around the map clockwise with me. You've got the Kurds, who have their American armed Peshmerga, who have the strength to keep the Islamic State out. Then you have the Shiite militias and the so-called Iraqi army, which is just the Shiite militias, really. And that's all the land, from Baghdad to Kuwait. And then, of course, backed by the Iranians, including the war is really being run right now by General Qassem Soleimani, who's the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. So that's the Shiite enemy of the Islamic State to their east. Then in the south, you have the Saudis, which they can hardly even get to Saudi, probably. And the Saudis, of course, have been perfectly happy to see ISIS and al-Nusra hurt Assad in Syria, but they do not want to be overthrown in an Islamic State-style revolution against their kingdom in Saudi. So they have every reason in the world to work very hard to keep the Islamic State bottled up there in Iraqi Sunni stan. And then you got Egypt, which is way too far. And if it was run by the Muslim Brotherhood, it would be on our side. But since America did a coup d'etat and overthrew the Arab Spring elected Muslim Brotherhood government and reinstalled the military dictatorship, now under Field Marshal Fatah al-Sisi, they are absolutely America and Israel's sock puppet once again, and the Saudis' sock puppet as well, and have their own problems with ISIS in the Sinai Peninsula and can be counted on to keep, not to invade, but to keep ISIS out. And then continuing along clockwise, you've got Jordan, which presumably has a strong enough army to keep them out, even if not actually invade. And then you have what's left of Syria, run by the Ba'athist Shiite minority coalition government of Bashar al-Assad that controls all of the major cities in Syria except for Raqqa in the east. And so they're completely landlocked. The Islamic State is completely landlocked by enemies. They have no trading partners. Where the Taliban in Afghanistan in the 1990s were recognized by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Pakistan, the Islamic State is recognized by no one, and it never will be. There's not a single state on this planet that would do business with the Islamic State. Hell, maybe the North Koreans would just for public relations, but again, they're completely landlocked. The North Koreans couldn't even get them anything they wanted to sell them, anyway. So this Islamic State regime is basically stuck. They've got their Islamo-fascist caliphate out in worthless desert in the crappiest part of Iraq that the Shia and Kurds left them after George Bush's war for Shiistan. And so they have no future. They're on an equation for bankruptcy already. The Rand Corporation did a study about 6 months ago that estimated their annual revenue at approximately $2 billion. $2 billion? A year? And I tried to get the guy on the show, actually, but he wrote a thing for Politico magazine where this was supposed to be a concern. This was like, oh, my God, can you believe it? The Islamic State is earning as much as $2 billion a year in revenue. The American Empire spends $2 billion getting out of bed in the morning. Are you kidding me? $2 billion, that's nothing. That's like Mike Myers, $1 million ransom or whatever thing. That's nothing. That's absolutely nothing. So the Islamic State, okay, maybe they're the richest, most powerful terrorist group in the world, but they sure are the poorest, crappiest state in the world. They're nothing. I bet probably the absolute smallest states in Europe have a bigger GDP than the Islamic State. And then here's what we really have going for us with these guys. And that is that the people of Iraq, the Sunni population of Iraq that have actually been conquered by them, they're not Saudis. They're Iraqis. They don't all walk around in robes and veils and burqas all day. That's not how they live. They dress like Westerners. They've lived in a very Westernized country. It was a very secular country under Saddam Hussein, where women even taught college in blue jeans and this kind of thing. And so the Iraqi Sunnis have already proven in 2006 and 2007 that when the Islamic State, and they even tried to call themselves that back then, after Zarqawi was killed in early 2006, they renamed their group the Islamic State of Iraq. And the local Iraqi Sunnis said, no, you don't, and shot them all to death. Now, if you ask the Republicans, they'll tell you that David Petraeus gets the credit for that. But all David Petraeus did was show up at the end. And he gave the Sunnis money and guns and allowed them to patrol their own neighborhoods if they would agree to stop attacking the United States and if they would agree to continue the killing of al-Qaeda that they had already decided to turn. So there's just no reason to believe at all that millions of Iraqi Sunnis are going to let the Islamic State stand and rule them for any extended period of time. Unless, of course, the Americans intervene on the side of the Shia and drive the people into their homes, which is, I guess, another question.
I am not a man. I am a free man.
Don't work. necessarily to acquit them. They're still malevolent. Things never work out the way they plan anyway. You know what I mean? Like, Iraq was supposed to be easy. Libya was supposed to be easy. Syria was supposed to be easy. Not this complete clusterfuck, you know? All right, guys. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm here at the Radisson Hotel in Manchester, New Hampshire, at the Liberty Forum. And if you're anywhere nearby, you've got about half an hour to get here. Well, 40 minutes to get here before my speech starts. It's going to be a lot like this, only different. Pretty much the same thing, against the terror war. To go ahead and spoil it for you, the Empire got us into this mess. The Empire made everything worse, and now the Empire wants to make everything even more worse than that, and so we shouldn't let them. That's the speech, okay? It's everybody's fault but mine, and the solution is to just stop. So if I can get from, the introduction through the end of that in half an hour, then somebody owes me $10 or something, because it'll be a miracle. It'll be a miracle. I swear, I cut out major portions of this speech, and then look at it. It's 5 pages long. It's a wreck. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Professor Scott.
Would you like to join me on the radio here? Yeah. Hey, everybody, guess what? Jeff Tucker just showed up.
Yep.
Which is going to make it easy for me to fill time here.
Yeah, no problem.
Let's see, we got mic 3 hot. Go ahead.
Is this it?
You're on.
Okay, good.
Jeff Tucker, everyone,
right.
From Liberty.me and
That's
the Foundation
right.
for Economic Education.
All those things are happening.
Very good to see you.
You too. So often when we talk, it's just over digits, and now here we are in the flesh.
Absolutely.
So you look fabulous.
Well, yeah. Thank you very much.
Did you bring your skateboard with
dressed
you?
Dressed to the nines, as always, of course. Yeah.
No, but you didn't bring your longboard with you, did you?
No, I don't have a longboard.
You don't? Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know the right terminology.
No, I did bring a Thrasher magazine that I got at the airport.
Okay.
Skater of the Year, Wes Kremer, and... doing it right in here, man.
So the idea of skateboarding is to have an element of freedom in your life and total control and autonomy and it's creativity and a certain amount of...
I think, Jeff, I've always been a libertarian.
Yeah, there's certain spontaneous order that comes with a group of skateboarders getting together.
That's true.
I've seen this.
And it's all about individual accomplishment, but with your friends. You don't against your friends. You skate with them.
Right.
Against yourself.
And you do a cool trick and they cheer you on, and if you mess up, they kind of, bolster you.
And if you nail it, you and only you get the credit. That's what it's really all about, actually making the thing that has been very difficult that you've been unable to make. And then when you make it, then you get to say,
So you set your own standards, basically.
Feeling.
I mean, you measure yourself against yourself.
Absolutely.
Individual. My office used to be next to a sort of a skateboard crowd, and I watched them one day, and I saw exactly a little micro society
in
development.
It.
Yeah. Very
and we
beautiful.
All cheer for each other, too. Here's what you'll always hear at a skateboard session. Yeah!
That's cool. Right?
Yeah.
I like it. I like everything about skateboarding, but I don't know how. To actually do
probably
the
probably should learn when you're 12 or forget.
Well, I tried it at a party one time after a few drinks, and I landed on my back.
Probably try before a few drinks.
Right.
A slightly sloped driveway,
right.
See how it goes.
Now,
some people just got the talent. I'm not saying it's too late for you. It might not be.
I don't know what you mean by too late.
Usually you got to learn when you're a kid or you just can't. That's pretty much the deal.
Okay, I get it. Yeah.
Young at heart.
Yeah, that's
sometimes.
But it doesn't sometimes overcome physical reality. Right. So is this your first Liberty Forum?
Yes, this is the first
time. So what do you
think?
What's your impression? It's these are your peeps.
Yeah, it's very cool. Now, I have been to New Hampshire once before. I gave a talk to some college students here, to the Young Americans for Liberty in, I don't know if it was in this town or another one, Jeff, honestly. It was 5 years ago, but... I sure like this place. I like the whole idea of the Free State Project and all that. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, it's got a great spirit to the conference. This is sort of a can-do, applied liberty sort of thing. So it's not just about theory.
Right.
It's about finding ways to be free in the one life you have. And I think there's really something to say for that. In fact, I think it's kind of a higher level or like Liberty 2.0 or something like that. Like, you get beyond just reading about it or hoping that it happens at some point in your life because... the political winds change or whatever. And you say, to hell with that. I'm going to take freedom into my own hands and do something about it insofar as I'm able and help to build up the institutions of liberty and basically make government as irrelevant as possible, you know? And in that way, hopefully we can make the state obsolete. I think it's happening, actually. I do, more and more so.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think at the very least, this kind of thing is a great way to advertise libertarianism to
new people.
There's so many Americans who've never even heard the word or had an opportunity to really understand it.
Yeah, and I don't even, you know, for my part, I don't even care if a person adopts that term. What we need is people to sort of, you know, dig deep and find that thing within them that wants to be free. That's more important than anything else. Would you like some Skoll?
No, thank you.
Okay.
I do appreciate it, but I quit tobacco 3 years ago.
Okay, I felt rude just dipping here without, you know, offering you some.
So. I am off the nicotine.
Okay.
Permanently.
Okay.
Don't even miss it. In fact, I'm lucky because the wife smokes Marlboro Lights, which I hate and always have hated, so I'm not even tempted to start again.
You mean cigarettes in general you hate?
Yeah, well, yes.
Or Marlboro Lights in particular. I mean,
Marlboro Lights
Camels,
have always been a problem for me, so I'm not tempted to bum one from the wife ever. Now, if she smokes Camel
that's
filters,
why she
I might have given
them.
In.
See, that's why she smokes Marlboro.
I guess so, yeah. I might have given in if it was my brand.
Well, I have a friend who carries only menthol cigarettes because she's convinced that people don't bum them at bars.
That's a good point, yeah. I knew a guy in high school like that, too.
Yeah, this is strategic thinking,
absolutely,
really.
Absolutely, yeah.
But what are we talking about today besides this meaningless prattle?
Well, I was thinking I could ask you a little bit about libertarianism and anti-imperialism. I spoke with a newspaper reporter a little while ago, and I told him that anti-imperialism is at the core of libertarianism. And then right after I told him that, I wondered whether it was really true.
Yeah.
I like to think that it is, Jeff, and it certainly is at the core of my libertarianism.
Well, you know what, though, Scott? You make a very interesting point, because I think in theory you're right. In practice, it's been a long time getting there. You know, if you think about it, libertarianism was sort of, how would you say, maybe it was given life sometime at the end of World War II, you know, in the American political context anyway. But I think it was another 50 years, essentially, before we sort of got it right. The unity of love of liberty at home with a kind of foreign policy interests, I guess you could say, that were essentially united around the idea of peace. Because for generations, you know, people imagined that you could sort of hold a foreign imperialist aggressive view, garrison sort of state view towards foreign policy, while believing in limited government at home. In fact, my friend, M. Stanton Evans, do you know that name?
It sounds familiar.
Yeah, no, he was a kind of, you know, early person in sort of right-wing circles. You know, he was a friend of Buckley's, but also a friend of, he studied under Mises, and a very interesting sort of journalist, Indianapolis News or something like that. But he wrote for Human Events for years. But he was one of these, they called themselves fusionists. Mm-hmm. Frank Meyer was their guru, really.
Right.
And so they had radical libertarian views insofar as it affected economics and even to some extent social policy and that
kind
sort of thing.
Hurts the foreign policy though to mix it up with the right.
Well, and
well,
then
please explain, Jeff. Yep. We got to take
okay.
this break.
Yeah, we should talk about this more. It's very interesting.
Yeah, we'll pick this up on the other side of the break. Talking with the great Jeff Tucker from Liberty.me here live at the Liberty Forum in Manchester, New Hampshire.
It was the Cold War, I think, that drove a lot of it.
That's what I was going to say. Having a communist, which is, again, stupid and crazy and wrong. The Assad regime is harmless. He's never picked a fight with the Israelis. That's what they think makes sense. All right, you guys. Welcome back here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. Now, I hope Ian is going to come and bail me out in 10 minutes.
Oh, is that right? We only have 10 minutes left?
Because then I'm on in 10 minutes after that.
You're on what? You're on Free Talk?
I'm doing the speech.
You're
at the top of the hour,
speech.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I need Ian to come in and cover my last segment for me, but anyway.
So this is your big chance to lay it all out.
This is
you're talking about terrorism. That's a big topic.
I got way too much here, Jeff.
Yeah, I know. Well, that always happens to me, too. I end up having like 3 days of speeches, you know. The one time, it was recently, I was invited to Washington to give a talk, and I loved it because it was like I was scheduled to speak from 1 until 5.
Now, see, I could do that. That would be easier for me.
Right?
I could just not have to worry about running out of time.
I had 200 people in a room from 1 to 5. I gave one break.
Wow.
Yeah. That's ideal.
How many of them came back after the break?
No, everybody was talking. No, and then we still talked afterwards. You know, but that's, I love that because I sort of laid it all out. You know, I just basically broke it down into four parts and just turned on and just went straight through from the beginning to the end. I love that. It's a great way to speak. I love having the whole afternoon. I always run out of time. You know, always.
I'm going to do my best to keep you and Anthony Gregory and Tom Woods and mine and other friends of mine who are so good at giving speeches, who just get right up there like they always own the place and just make themselves at home. I get so nervous before I give a speech. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it just means that you need to speak more. That's all.
Yeah.
You need to do more often. That's all. You know,
it's the same speech I give on the show every day. Usually I can't see you and you can't see me. So it feels like a lot easier.
Some people get more nervous in that digital realm. They have to have an audience. Yeah. So, yeah.
I guess I'm just used to it. I used to get way nervous before the show, too.
Did you?
I finally got over it just doing it year after year.
But now this is year 12 you've been doing the show. Am I right about that?
Let's see. 98. I can't do math. I started in 98.
Oh, much earlier than I thought. I thought it was 2003.
Now, 2003 is when I started the interview show.
I see.
And then 2007 is when I started really doing a daily show for pay.
Yeah.
So that was in 07. So that's 8 years ago now.
Yeah.
So,
but earlier we were talking about the U.S. foreign policy problem and libertarianism. And I do think it's interesting that we went basically 40 years with most people that accepted sort of libertarian ideas for domestic policy, rejected them in terms of international politics. So you had this sort of murderous, you know, sort of longings for nuclear war on the one hand abroad, on the other hand arguing for tax cuts and deregulation at home, which is it doesn't work, really.
And part of it, because the USSR was a communist state, so basically that kind of...
Well,
confused the issue a little bit.
It did, and that was, I think, the whole reason why Harry Truman hatched the Cold War, right? I mean, you know, the goal after World War II was to continue the corporate subsidies. That was the goal. How do you transfer money out of the American taxpayers into the hands of large corporations that constituted the ruling class that basically benefited from the war, and they wanted to continue to live at others' expense? The best way to do that was to concoct this whole communist scare, you know, which took some doing. It was an Orwellian trick, because you recall that Russia was our ally,
right?
Gallant, beautiful bringer of democracy to the world during World War II. And then just a few days later, you know, after the war settles down, it's like, whoops, oh, my God. It turns out Russia's really evil, godless communism. They're spreading it all over Europe. We have to stop it. The only way to stop it is through U.S. foreign policy. And hence the Marshall Plan, you know. And this
was a way, you're saying, for Truman to neutralize classical liberalism
and
at
so
home.
There was that hysteria about the Greek election. Oh, my God, the Greeks like communists. You know, big surprise there, right? That's always been true, I guess. It really triangulated everybody on the right. And there's a funny aspect to this, Scott, too, because the people on the right who are just, you know, famously stupid, but they always think they're smart. They were glad for Truman's switch on the Russia question, because they wanted to, this is just bizarre, they wanted to show up FDR, because they really resented, the right wing really resented this, FDR's road to Moscow, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so they liked this 1947-1948 shift in, U.S. foreign policy priorities, because they thought it made FDR look bad. That was part of it. It's like, see, Russia
after 20 years of treason and FDR sucking up to Stalin, now we're going to reverse
that, and so he's going to look back. So the right wing supported the Marshall Plan and then jumped on with the Cold War. And there were very few dissenters. You know, one was our beloved St. John T. Flynn, you know, who had his articles, you know, routinely rejected by National Review and died completely in obscurity in something like 1957.
Well, and he had been a classical liberal, not a conservative, correct? Before that?
Yeah. You know, of course, this term conservatism, as far as I could tell, was basically invented after World War II to describe this new form of thinking. Before World War II, there hadn't been organized to anything called a conservatives. Chodorov used to say that if you ever called him a conservative, he would punch you in the nose, you know. Mm-hmm. And I really like that. So Russell Kirk invented the term. And it's very strange, because it used to be about, you know, fighting for human rights and liberty and everything. And then under Kirk's tutelage, it became about, you know, watch fobs and large leather chairs and sort of a, you know, fake accents and, you know, phony British style, you know, affectations and, plus, you know, sort of tipping the hat to U.S. imperialism abroad. The whole thing became just disgusting. fasting. Of course, Murray Rothbard was a great outlier in this whole period.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. This apparently was all completely ridiculous on its face to him. Scare the hell out of him,
it
Harry.
Was.
Never worked on Murray.
But, you know, the funny thing about Murray is it would have been so easy for him to just shut up about U.S. foreign policy and to make it build a pretty good career for himself. I mean, he was a beloved economist, and he could have been writing for National Review, speaking for the great sort of CIA-controlled right wing, and, you know, had a decent life. But you just could not shut Murray up, you know, and he wouldn't stop talking about U.S. imperialism and the essential lies on which the Cold War was based. And he lived kind of a lonely life, really, for a very long time. Do you know there was one point that he was completely out of a job, and he actually started writing encyclopedia entries for a living. Yeah, he actually, and they weren't published, but he was writing like for large scale encyclopedia sets and stuff like that.
It's amazing.
So,
he could be that marginalized.
I know. And then finally, in the mid 1970s, of course, you have the early 1970s, the birth of libertarianism as we know it today. But even there, I think it took until about 1990 for things to really cohere, because you know you had to wait
the fall of the USSR.
It was the end of the Cold War, essentially. That's when finally we started getting some sense on among libertarians about U.S. foreign policy. But it's not entirely there, right? I mean, even now.
Yeah, even now, most of the libertarian movement comes from the right. So even if they're kind of, Tucker, I guess I should be anti-war, like you say, it still doesn't matter that much to them.
But there's more anti-war sentiment on the libertarian among libertarians now than I think there's ever been in my lifetime. I mean, Students for Liberty came out with this very beautiful book called, I think it's just, you know, The Case for Peace, something like that. Mm-hmm. Really a good collection of essays. And this is rather new. I think it's good. It's becoming much more the orthodoxy, and the hawks and these kinds of people are very much in the minority at these events.
Well, especially, you know, the young people coming up now, the college kids and whatever, they've lived through Bush and Obama, right?
Yeah.
The liberal Republican and the conservative Democrat, the centrist extremists who agree with each other on every single freaking thing. So who could be 20 and not be a libertarian right now? You know,
I think that's exactly right. And to have some sympathy for people like Edward Snowden and
sure.
You know, I was just at the ISFLC meeting where he spoke, you know, to almost 2,000 students, and, you know, like a live feed, you know, video feed from of all places, Moscow, right?
Yes.
I still can't quite,
great?
You know, process that. Isn't that something?
Yeah, it's like when John Ashcroft announced that we've turned Jose Padilla over to George Tenet and Donald Rumsfeld to be tortured. He was actually in Red Square giving the announcement in Russia.
Isn't that something?
the
way history turns, it's just extraordinary. Have you seen Citizen Four?
I actually have not. I got it off the Pirate Bay, but I haven't gotten a chance to look at it yet.
Okay, you got it from the right place.
By the way, are you a Pirate Bay aficionado? Because if you're not, you will be.
I'm a huge fan. I just prefer streaming stuff. And so I stream Citizen Four.
Oh, okay.
I
could imagine you being the all-time world's greatest champion of the Pirate Bay.
But you know what? Wait till the end of that movie.
Is that the music? Oh, the music's playing.
Yeah,
we got it.
Yeah, but you'll see.
Right back with Jeff Tucker in just a second.
Right at the end of Citizen Four, Obama comes on and calls for the prosecution of Snowden. And I tell you what, if you had any sympathy, it makes me very sad. This is one of my dearest friends. But we've all been. You did.
No. I told that guy whatever. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm doing a live remote. I'm excited, man. This is great. I'm at the New Hampshire Liberty Forum in Manchester, New Hampshire, which is a really nice town. I saw it out my hotel window this morning.
Learn to work all these buttons? I'm seeing you over there managing this massive machinery.
I'm ignoring most of those.
Okay.
Buttons. It's this one and this one.
Two
buttons. You and I are on. Other than that, I'm leaving it alone. This is Ian's territory.
Because it looks complicated to me.
It is. It is.
Like, I feel like I'd have to train for a week.
If my elbow bumps this thing, we're done.
I see.
Anyway, I think we're all right. But, yes, Ian Freeman is the one with the computer genius setup.
Yeah, he's always doing things, you know.
He's the man that makes LRA run for sure.
Right. He looks like a DJ, you know, behind the, you know. Right. So earlier we were talking about the whole problem of the ruling class.
Wait.
No, what?
Everybody, it's Jeff Tucker. You know the voice. It's Jeff Tucker.
Really?
Yeah.
But, you know, my voice is a little bit not the way
it
should
be. You have
a
great radio voice.
Well, thank you. But, you know, I'm a little under the weather right now. So that's what accounts for the sort of manly grovelingness.
It makes you sound even better.
There we go. Okay, right.
So it's the great Jeff Tucker from the Foundation for Economic Education.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And from Liberty.me.
That's right.
And he's the my partner in our monthly new show that
we've
had.
We have a great new show.
We've had one new show so far, one episode, the premiere.
And people loved it. It was crowded, and people were all over it.
Yeah,
Eye on the Empire.
Great response from
that
too.
Yeah, I did too.
And I realized I'm going to have to actually wear a suit to do the show.
Do you think so? You know, I have a bow tie for you if you want. It's up in my room. It's a Liberty.me bow tie. Would you let me put it on you?
Yes.
Okay.
I would.
We'll have to get some of this.
I don't know whether I'll be able to tie it again myself for the next episode.
It's just
of the
like
show.
A shoe. It's just like tying a shoe. It's just like tying a shoe, you tie a shoe,
well,
right?
That I can do.
Yeah, you have a shoe, you have laces on your shoes.
I do.
Yeah, okay, not everybody does.
I've graduated up from Velcro.
Yeah.
I'm doing good.
Velcro.
In Manchester, New Hampshire?
That's
oh, rad. I always thought the Velcro was the greatest invention ever. Give that
yeah,
name.
Okay,
here
that's
I am
a
in the
little bit of an exaggeration. I mean, wait. You know, I think it's a good thing, Velcro.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Not ever.
Yeah, I think that was a little over the top, Scott.
Yeah. Okay, I accept that. I get over the top a little sometimes. All right, so I got Jeff Tucker, the great Jeff Tucker here. Ian Freeman.
Hey.
The man. Uh-oh, I better hit your button here.
Thank you.
Ian Freeman's here from Free Talk Live, and now in about...
I've never been on your show before.
That's true.
Yeah.
Welcome.
We've been working together for years, and I've never been on his show.
I'm very happy to have you here. I'm on in 10 minutes.
Like speaking on. You
I'm
have to be
a speech,
out there speaking.
Yeah, I have
right.
to be out of here and in the other room to give my speech 10 minutes from now, so I'm probably going to bug out of here in a few minutes so yep. I go and get
They'll
set
wait
up.
For you.
But at the break, we were talking, Jeff, about the interests behind the empire. Now, I think probably, without being the master of all history, I think probably the United States, American Empire, has the greatest public relations in the history of empires. The British public relations was, we are here to kill you and take your grain and starve you to death. All hail the Queen of England or whatever, right?
Yeah.
The Americans pretend that they're killing you for their best interests. Mm. And that's been their shtick, basically, since the end of World War II. In fact, it wasn't until the end of the Cold War
yeah.
that so many conservatives like Chalmers Johnson and Eric Margolies yeah. and others went, you know what? We really always were an empire. It wasn't just about containing communism. It really was about expanding world empire. And it took until the end of the USSR for them to even get it.
40 years went by.
So this is some really successful PR. But so tell me, what's the real truth,
Jeff? But here's the thing. I think the line that you're presenting here with regard to U.S. foreign policy mirrors the domestic equivalent. You know, every government program is helping people. I mean, even those that are obviously egregious, right? You know, like minimum wage is a great example. Of that, I mean, it keeps people out of the workforce. That's why we had minimum wages in the first place, is keep people from getting jobs. Basically, didn't want those people getting work and propagating themselves. So, but rather than just say that, you know, they say the opposite. The purpose is to help people, and it's the same thing with U.S. foreign policy. So, what is the purpose of the state? That's a big question because. From my point of view, we don't need it. It doesn't actually do anything but steal our stuff and diminish our liberties. So what's its purpose? What's its real function? Why does it exist in the first place? That's a big question. And it took me a long time to figure this out, but I think the answer is actually relatively simple. It's the tool by which the ruling class exploits everybody else. That's it. Mm-hmm. It's not complicated, actually.
Now, is that kind of Marx Okamia you to call him the ruling class, Mr. Free Market Libertarian?
No, I don't think so.
I prefer parasites.
Yeah, well, that's a decent term. But really, there's a way in which, I mean, the state is exogenous to society, but it also serves the largest interests in society, the largest corporations, the largest financial interests, the biggest banks. And really there is a class structure behind it. Yeah. It was born out of a class structure, at least in the 20th century form.
Well, you know, Gareth Porter is my favorite reporter. If you ever listen to the show, you've heard me interview him 100 times. And he's some kind of leftist or progressive, or what have you. But when it comes to the empire, he puts it all on the generals and the spies and the national security state. He says, you know, Lockheed and Citigroup and whatever vested billionaire interests are nothing compared to a bunch of generals with a bunch of ribbons on their shirt. And you give a general a base in Kazakhstan and just watch as he comes up with reasons why he's got to keep it and got to stay and got to get promoted.
But I think aren't all these parts of the ruling class essential in a way? I mean, you have to have the generals, you have to have the corporate interests, you have to have the Federal Reserve to fund all the nonsense. You've got to have the politicians grandstanding. And they all come together in a grand conspiracy.
And that's why they call it We the People.
Yeah,
so we won't see it for exactly what it is. Right. Them, the people,
it's
versus
It's very
the rest
difficult
of us.
To see this, actually. This truth is guarded in a way. And we're protected from it because of the language of the left and the language of the right, which are in many ways like mirror images of each other, but neither one is really telling the truth about what's going on.
Yeah, very fair point.
So, this is a very interesting topic. I think I'm going to make it the whole topic of my Sunday speech. I've got it pretty well mapped out. In fact, it's the subject of my next book.
Oh, great. You know, there have been quite a few books written recently. There's one called American Coup by William Arkin, who, not a libertarian at all, former Washington Post reporter. And there's quite a few books like this.
What's the coup? Is it post 9/11?
Yeah, post 9/11 about the rise of the homeland security state. And if you thought we had a national security state after 1947, the homeland security state that has grown up since September 11th, and the national security state too, but just, and this is really kind of the Cheney policy. It's that weird bastardized, should be spelled different version of privatization of government functions.
Yeah.
It's not libertarian privatization where the government goes to hell and lets the market take care of it. It's where the government hires mercenaries to carry out all their dirty work. Edward Snowden was not an NSA. He was at Booz Allen Hamilton, working for the NSA. And they have just contracted out so much of this. And remember in the Iraq War where Halliburton or Blackwater would kill somebody, and they would say, well, so who's going to prosecute them? And the American courts would say, well, it's not up to us. Ask the military. And the military would say, well, it's not up to us. Ask the Iraqi courts. And the Iraqi courts will say, well, Bush won't give us jurisdiction over Blackwater, guys. I guess you're going to have to ask the Department of Justice. And they're getting away with murder, basically, because no one's really in charge.
Pass
the buck. There is no system set up for any kind of accountability for these guys. And we have just, it's almost unmeasured. It's almost as invisible as the rest of the state that's been built in secrecy since September.
You know what it reminds me of as you're talking? It reminds me of very much the way the pre-modern states functioned. They were more or less sort of private exploitation agencies. Mm-hmm. The king would give certain monopolistic privileges to certain people to go out and collect taxes or wage war or whatever, and they could do what they want so long as they paid the king, you know, some portion of the proceeds, and then otherwise they would get protection from the king, you know. But other than that, they didn't really work directly for the king. They worked for themselves. And they were more or less hired, you know, but they were private exploitation agencies.
More things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah,
yeah, or a little bit of just
reverting
back to
form. But, you know, it's funny
because
the idea of liberalism is that, no, that's shit. We should have laws, you know, and the state should have defined functions and stuff like that, you know. But, of course, we're living in a post-liberal age in a sense. The state has become truly, truly total. It has been for a while, I would say. In fact, I kind of resist some of this language about the coup, post 9/11 coup, because in many ways it was a follow up to what everything the state aspired to do before 9/11. You know, it wasn't as if it was a sudden transformation. We were once free and now we're not.
You know what the real coup was? The coup was in getting the American people to repeat the mantra that everything changed. Go ahead and have your way with me now.
Right.
Everything changed. That was the coup. Because before that, okay, you know, maybe we've got a crisis, but this is still America, and we still have our Constitution.
And to put up with the police
state.
We
still believe in liberty and justice, right? And then, no, everything changed. Liberty and justice are now last on the list.
Now, martial law have to be a permanent state of being, basically, yeah.
All right, that's the music. I'm done. Thanks, everybody.
Okay.
Live audience.
Hey, Scott.
I really like having a live audience. It was great. It made me very nervous, but I appreciate it. I'm on in room C here in just a minute. Thanks for listening.